Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
It's really ridiculous. It's almost comical if it wasn't so sad and so dangerous, as you say. The idea that Russia is going to interfere in the Canadian election is just totally absurd. It's laughable. I call it recycled red baiting.
That's the voice of Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network. In this week's show, we speak to Bruce about the ongoing coup attempts in Venezuela and how this dangerous action is causing global insecurity. Stay tuned. Online, I have longtime activist and peace advocate Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and publisher of a blog called Organizing Notes. Hey, welcome to the show, Bruce.
Great to be with you again.
Now, for our listeners who are not quite up to date or not aware of what's happening in Venezuela, can you give us just a brief summary of what's going on there and what is the U.S. role in this unrest?
Well, the U.S. is orchestrating a coup trying to depose the several times elected government of Nicolas Maduro with a young guy by the name of Guaido, who the U.S. has selected and who has said that once in power, if he's able to get into power, that he would turn over the oil supplies of Venezuela, which is the largest supply on the planet Earth, even more than Saudi Arabia, he would turn it over to the United States oil corporations. So clearly, this is illegal under international law. It's illegal to interfere with another government, another sovereign state. It's illegal to try to impose your puppet on another country that's had several elections and duly elected. In fact, Jimmy Carter, the former president, he monitors a lot of elections. He has said that the last several Venezuelan elections were the best ones he'd ever seen, the most fairest ones ever. So the U.S. is doing everything it can to demonize and Venezuela in order to topple it. And so far, they're hanging on, and in spite of everything the United States is trying to do.
Now, shamefully, Canada and many European nations quickly declared Guaido the new, president who was handpicked in a public square and sworn in. Now, have any time in your history of a peace advocate, have you ever seen such a blatant and naked U.S. intervention? I mean, they're not even trying to hide it. They're just open about it, and they're just really verbose. Have you ever seen such an incidence of such boldness in a military coup?
Well, I've read about some, in the past, Guatemala, for example, Iran, where they were pretty blatant about it in those times too. But I do think that's probably one of the most, if not certainly the most blatant of all. But the U.S. did one in 2014 in Ukraine that was, I followed it literally daily on the on YouTube, watching videos real time. That one was fairly blatant too, because U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland in the Obama government was bragging about it in a conversation with the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine at the time, a guy by the name of Jeffrey Piot, saying, we've got to install this guy. To hell with the EU. F the EU, she said. They wanted somebody else. So, and that was all publicized, although the mainstream media in America didn't pick up on it, nor the Canadians, I'm sure. So, the U.S. is doing a lot of this kind of thing these days because it's getting desperate. Its empire is crumbling around the world, in spite of the fact that the U.S. has more than 800 military bases around the planet. It's crumbling and crumbling fast, and so the U.S. is really trying to impose its will in as many places as possible to try to grab that back, grab that control and domination back, but I'm afraid it's not going to succeed.
For me, never before have I seen so blatant the kind of international racism. They said all the countries that matter, the white European countries in North America, they don't talk about Mexico or Bolivia, all of Africa, with the exception of, I think, one country in Africa is not, you know, supporting the U.S. Most of Asia is not supporting the U.S. Like, most of the world's countries are not supporting the U.S. Can you speak to this kind of international kind of colonial order?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the big countries, Russia and China, Iran, Mexico, Ecuador, Bolivia, you know, a whole host of countries, Turkey, India, you know, a lot of the biggest countries in the world are not supporting this operation. And but again, that's not what you hear. What you do hear in the media is those countries that do support it. But just to show you the kind of arrogance and ignorance, when I was in D.C. this past weekend for No to NATO protest, a friend showed me his phone, and on there was a story from Fox News, and it said that three Mexican countries that Trump was going to cut our subsidies to three Mexican countries. Three Mexican countries? I mean, this just goes to show how crazy our country is and how illiterate it is about the rest of the world and how, you know, it doesn't really care. It's unbelievable.
As you know, Venezuela has economic and military connections to Russia and China, who are heavily invested there. Both those countries have spoke out at the UN against the coup with many other countries. Russia has sent some military support to Venezuela, as reported in the news, and the U.S. seems to be in a frenzy, and Trump tells Russia to get out of Venezuela. Can you speak to the hypocrisy of the U.S. telling Russia to get out of Venezuela while at the same time they're building bases in Eastern Europe?
Well, not only that, Russia not only has been sending 100 military advisors and military equipment, they've also been sending a lot of food. And China's been sending a lot of medicines to the people there. You know, one of the major reasons for the whole crisis, economic crisis in Venezuela, is U.S. sanctions. In the United States, the Citgo oil company is owned by Venezuela. And so Citgo gas stations, people go there, they fill up. Normally, those profits are sent back to Venezuela because they belong to Venezuela. U.S. won't let them be sent. So the U.S. is essentially stealing that money. And then Venezuela has a bunch of gold in the Bank of London, or the Bank of England in London. And they asked for their gold back, and England wouldn't allow them to take it. So, you know, this is why they're in financial straits right now, is because England and the United States are blocking their own money from coming back to them when they requested it. That's illegal under international law. But yes, the hypocrisy is blinding. The United States, again, has 800 bases around the world. We send troops, we send weapons all over the place. So it's standard operating procedures. France does it, England does it, Germany does it. All kinds of countries do that. They send advisors, military. They have war games together, war exercises. U.S. routinely has war exercises in Korea. They have them in Norway and Sweden just in recent weeks, up in Finland, right on the Russian border, right aimed at Russia. But that's okay. But Russia sends 100 troops to Venezuela, and suddenly it's the worst thing in the world. It's just pure hypocrisy. And that's why most of the world just laughs at the United States and doesn't take it seriously anymore, because it's so hypocritical.
Now, speaking of Cold War rhetoric, in the news media, it's been amping up 24/7 with this kind of anti-Cold War rhetoric. Very few Democrats, with the exception of Tulsi Gabbard and a few others, have spoken out against this coup and the madness of kind of regime change wars. What kind of unnecessary risks do you feel we're being put into with this advantageous politicians and the media amping up tensions 24/7?
Well, it's terribly dangerous, and we see the Democrats really leading the way anymore. I think Tulsi Gabbard is one exception, but very few Democrats, really less than one handful of Democrats, are speaking out against this kind of demonization and rhetoric. At the same time, the United States has recently built, in the last couple of years, has built missile launch bases in Romania and Poland that can fire first-strike attack cruise missiles to reach Moscow in 10 to 12 minutes. These are missiles that could carry nuclear warheads or conventional warheads. Russia wouldn't know when they saw them coming which kind of a warhead they would have on them. They wouldn't have much time to respond. They would have to go ahead and fire their retaliatory strike, not knowing what kind of warhead was on these things. And the United States is, as I said a minute ago, wargaming a constant attack on Russia all the time. Just again last month, they had war games up in northern Sweden and Finland and Norway aimed at Russia, practicing an invasion. Just this last week, the U.S. sent bombers, B-52 bombers from England to Romania and to other parts of Europe, practicing an attack on Russia. So constantly, the U.S. is doing this kind of thing. And how are the Russians to respond? What if Russia had developed missile launch bases in Canada and in Mexico and was putting its warships on our two coasts, Atlantic and Pacific coasts, and doing war games, practicing an attack on the United States from neighboring countries? The United States would go ballistic. But when we do it, nobody cares. Nobody's supposed to pay any attention. Nobody's supposed to be concerned about it. Oh, we're the good guys. Well, what we're doing is putting a loaded gun to the head of Russia in this case, saying, you either do as we say, or we are going to take you out.
Now, speaking of good guys, when many people in around the world think of Canada, we have this kind of unearned reputation as being the sober state of second thought. We're supposed to have a progressive government here now, but as soon as Trump declared Guaido president, our minister, Chrystia Freeland, was very quick out the gate to declare him also president of Venezuela. And today, I quote her, she was saying that she fears foreign interference in our upcoming elections, which is code language for Russian interference. It couldn't be that this government is in the middle of a corruption scandal and has dozens of broken promises, but foreign meddling might be the reason. But has Russia become a scapegoat for, say, failed democratic domestic policies? And how dangerous and xenophobic is this becoming?
It's really ridiculous. It's almost comical if it wasn't so sad and so dangerous, as you say. The idea that Russia is going to interfere in the Canadian election is just totally absurd. It's laughable. I call it recycled red baiting. And in fact, there's a reason for all of this. And I've become convinced that much of it has to do with climate change. When you look at the melting of the Arctic ice and the Arctic Ocean, what country on the planet has the largest land border with the Arctic? Take a look at a map, and Russia has a huge border. Some years ago, the RAND Corporation in California, that was famous for writing the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg copied and smuggled out to the media during the Vietnam War that told the secret history of the Vietnam War. Well, that same RAND Corporation has come out with a study saying that we need to break Russia up into smaller countries, balkanize Russia, so that Western oil corporations can have greater access to that massive land border. And so it can grab that oil and natural gas that would be exposed because of climate change. And I believe this is really what's driving a lot of this. That's why we see the massive encirclement, the growth of NATO encroaching on Russia's borders. And I think it's because of that. And by now, don't we know the method of operation, as they say in law enforcement, the MO of this corporate criminal syndicate that runs the United States government, and I would submit the Canadian government as well? Don't we know what their MO is? Demonize Iraq, demonize Yugoslavia before that, during the Clinton administration, demonize Libya, demonize Syria, demonize Venezuela, all to justify intervention and regime change. It's the same old script over and over and over again. And that's what I think is driving this Russia demonization. It's Russia's vast amount of resources that it has access to.
It's so sad. You know, we see the melting glaciers, and all they care about is getting to that black gold at the bottom, which is actually quite tragic. Now, your organization is trying to counter some of this kind of demonization. You're sending a peace delegation to Russia. Can you speak about this a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, as tensions grow between the U.S. and Russia, and Washington pulls out of the ABM Treaty in 2002 that outlawed so-called missile defense systems, they pulled out of the INF Treaty, pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, we believe it's time for more contact and greater understanding between our nations. So this demonization of Russia has been nonstop in recent years all across the West, not just in the United States and Canada, but all across. And currently, the U.S. is twisting the arms of Sweden and Finland to try to get them to join NATO and to allow more and more war games in their lands. So we feel it's time to go and build a citizen's bridge between our countries and Russia, to go and see for ourselves, not to listen to the corporate-dominated media's lies, to go and we're going to visit Moscow, Crimea, the forbidden fruit, and then St. Petersburg, get to know the people as best we can in 2 weeks, listen to them, not go there and tell them what they ought to be doing or how they ought to think or how they ought to do what or whatever, but just to go and listen to them, ask questions, and share food with them, and then come back and share those stories with people in our respective countries, because we think that we can't rely on the corporate-dominated media. We can't rely on the corporate-dominated politicians to get us out of this fix we're in right now. And it's got to be done by the people.
Are there any Russian delegates meeting with you there? Like what kind of, who will you be talking to and when you get there?
It's going to be different in each of the three places we're going to. For example, in Moscow, at the hotel we're staying in, we rented a meeting room there, and every morning we're there for 5 days. Between 9 and noon, we're going to have three time slots, an hour each, where a different person, different Russian academic, expert on economy, expert on weapons policy, you know, military issues. We're going to have two guys from a rock and roll band who have a TV show. When I was there last October in Moscow, they interviewed me on their TV show that is widely seen on YouTube. And so a whole host of different kind of people we're going to have, a journalist and some other people as well. So these people are going to come and talk to us, and we'll ask them many questions. And then in the afternoons, we'll go and just be tourists and see Moscow. And then when we go to Crimea, we're going to spend a lot of time just meeting everyday people in different places, three different cities across Crimea. We're going to a kids' camp where children spend their summers. And people are going to go to a place where disabled children are treated, you know, so we're going to meet with teachers, we're going to meet with the media, we're going to meet with veterans. And then when we go to St. Petersburg, we're going to be there during the big, huge May 9th holiday. This is when they honor what they call the Immortal Regiment. You know, during World War II, when Hitler invaded the former Soviet Union, 28 million Soviet citizens were killed during that Hitler invasion before they eventually chased Germany out of their respective countries, all part of the Soviet Union. And so today, those veterans who died in that war are really honored, because they saved the people from the Nazis at a huge price. And so every May 9th, they have what they call a peace march, where people bring the photos of their relatives who fought against the Nazis. And so we've been invited to join that, to honor these people who defeated the Nazis. And so we'll be doing many, many, many different things in different parts of during the journey. So it should be, I think, giving us a nice view. Certainly not a complete view. It's a very large country. But I think going to those three places and meeting people in different contexts, we should get a decent feel for what people are thinking and saying.
And it's very important, too, to bring those stories and those messages back to America, where people like get such a distorted, dystopian view of a place and a people. And really, those people are just like everyone else, trying to raise a family, trying to make a living. And it's an important story to remember that Russia played a huge hand in defeating fascism, and the battles in the Eastern Front were gigantic, and we don't talk about them much, but there was a huge loss and sacrifice by the Russian armies to fight beat down fascism. So that's a very important story to carry forward.
Well, you know, in the United States, they claim that it was Americans that beat the Nazis. The Americans admittedly lost 500,000 people in World War II. That's a lot of people for sure. A lot of people that died fighting the Nazis. But you compare 500,000 to 28 million Soviets that died during that war. I mean, it's staggering. And but the United States never likes to give the Soviet Union and Russia any real credit for having really played an instrumental role in defeating the Nazis. It's been kind of wiped out of history, actually, out of Western history. It's certainly not wiped out of Russian history.
That's for sure. Now, Bruce, what do you say to people who are turning on the news and feeling a little discouraged and feeling like the whole world's kind of pushing in on them and they want a future for their children, they want social change? In this moment, what do you think people should be focusing on, or what do you think people best use of creating a better, more just world? What would your advice be to them?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge we're in big trouble right now. Our real enemy in the world today is called climate change and growing global poverty. And much of that has to do with the military. The U.S. military is the biggest contributor to climate change. The U.S. military has the largest carbon footprint on the planet. So if we want to protect our children and grandchildren's future, make sure they have a chance for life on this beautiful planet, then we've got to convert the military-industrial complex. We have to move away from endless war. We have to move away from endless spending, massive spending on weapons technologies, and instead be building commuter rail systems, offshore wind turbines, solar power, tidal power systems, rehabilitating homes and buildings so that they're energy efficient, all these kind of things that help us deal with that existential problem called climate change. And studies show that when you make those kind of investments rather than military, you actually create more jobs. Now, everybody says they want to see more jobs. All the politicians say they want to see more jobs. This is the way to do it. But this isn't going to happen unless the peace movement, the environmental movement, the labor movement, the social justice movement call for the conversion of the military-industrial complex. We have to remember the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, who said that the United States was the largest purveyor of violence in the world. And he called for an end to U.S. war making. And this is exactly what we need to be talking about today as well.
You sound like that politician, a very exciting OAC, a new Green Deal. So you believe if they pull back on the military budget, they can invest in things like a new Green Deal?
Yeah, but one of my criticisms, it's a friendly criticism of the Green New Deal as it's currently written, is it doesn't talk about where they're going to get the money to do all this stuff. Because we're talking, in order to be effective, in order to really deal with climate change, we're talking about a complete reordering of the industrial society that we live in, that we collectively live in. And that's going to take massive investment. And where's that money going to come from unless we take it from the weapons industry? In the case of the United States, when you add up all the various pots of gold that are used on the Pentagon and war making and everything else, nuclear weapons, that's in the Department of Energy budget, so it's not counted as part of the Pentagon budget. When you add it all up, it's $1 trillion a year. You take a significant portion of that money, we can still have a defense, but nobody's going to invade us anyway. you invest that money into dealing with climate change, it's a whole new world. But it ain't going to happen unless we collectively demand it around this world, hand in hand together, protecting the future generations.
Absolutely. And even people like conservative Ron Paul is speaking out against regime change wars and saying there's no business for the U.S. to be involved in so many expensive conflicts that just make the situation worse for the people there. And they rob from the American people. They take money right out of the pockets of American workers, you know.
Yeah. You know, so unless we get really animated about it, we're going down. And so to me, it's a choice. What better way to spend your life than to fight for this beautiful planet and for our beautiful children and grandchildren's future? What could be more important? What could be more important? Making money? Buying a car? Having a fancy house? No, there's nothing more important. So all of us should be doing this. And we should be, in all of our political work, coordinating these efforts with the young people that are turning out for climate change. They're not making the connection to military pollution, military ozone depletion, rocket launches. You know, they're not making those connections. And so we have to go to them and say, hey, look, have you thought about this? And if we begin to work with people in these other movements and build a win-win articulation and solution, a transformative vision for the future, then we might actually be able to pull it off and do something good.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for spending a few moments with me, Bruce. What's the best way to get in touch and get more information about your work and what?
Go to our website, spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org, and it's the number or the word for spaceforpeace.org. And while you're there, look for the link to my blog called Organizing Notes, and I post pretty much every day what I'm up to, what I'm doing, what I'm organizing, what I'm seeing, what I'm experiencing.
Fantastic. And
get in touch.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.